Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's announcement today in an interview on ABC News that he thinks same-sex couples should be able to get married. Pennsylvania Law School Professor Tobias Wolff, who has participated in some of the highest-profile gay rights cases of the last several years, joins us to discuss Obama's evolution and the electoral implications of this policy shift. Then we'll examine the new coalition government Prime Minister Netanyahu has formed in Israel and get an analysis from Jennifer Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin, and Gabriel Peterberg, a professor of Middle East History at UCLA. We will discuss what this new Likud-Kadima coalition government will bring to the Israeli-Palestinian stalemate and what impact it is likely to have on Israel's foreign policy. Then finally, we will speak with British historian Robert Service, a professor of history at the University of Oxford and a fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. He served as an expert witness in the recent trial between the two Russian oligarchs, Boris Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich, and has written about the recent demonstrations in Russia in the New York Times. Robert Service is the author of the new book, Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. Joining us now is Tobias Wolff, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest-profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you so much, Ian. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And I imagine today is a day that a lot of people in this country have been waiting for, where the President of the United States has affirmed that he thinks that same-sex couples should be able to get married. What's your response?
I have extraordinary pride and admiration for this president. I've been working for the efforts of the president as an advisor to his campaign and then as certainly an ally to his administration for 5 years now. And I have never had the slightest doubt that the president's heart was in the right place on these issues. And the president confirmed that today in a very moving and a very thoughtful set of remarks. And I think it is a great day. I really do.
Well, the president said that he in many ways was influenced by his staff and his family and friends and neighbors. And also he talked about how soldiers and airmen and Marines and sailors who are out there fighting on my behalf and yet feel constrained, even now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone, because they're not able to commit themselves in a marriage. So it sounds like a lot of people in the inner circle have been weighing in on the president.
Well, I think that the president, it's always been the case that the president is a thoughtful and deliberative leader, and he gathers the information that he thinks he needs before he makes a decision. And to be sure, there are folks who have been, I suppose, pushing on this issue, both from the outside and perhaps also people whom he knows well. I've never had any doubt about his commitment to the issue of equality. And as he talked about today, he went through a process of figuring out what the right way and the best way was to affirm that commitment to equality for same-sex couples. And in that respect, it's a process that a lot of Americans are going through. And I think that the president's announcement today, the thoughtful interview that he gave today, is all the more valuable because I think that his thought process reflects the thought process of a lot of Americans. And I'm sure that the people that he knows well had an influence and gave him a perspective on the issue. I think it's also the case that this is an issue that over time, fair-minded people simply arrive at consensus. And sometimes it happens right away, and sometimes it takes longer. And certainly, the issue is still one that provokes disagreement. But over time, I think that a policy of equality under the law is the only policy that's going to prove to be on the right side of history.
But the president stressed that this is his personal position and that he still supports the concept of states deciding the issue on their own. And as you know, Tobias Wolff, just yesterday, the state of North Carolina, the voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional ban on gay marriage. So what practical effect does the president's stand, his new position that he's taken today, what will it have?
Well, I think that what the president said in part is that, states and the political process in states that are taking this up through the political branches of government, you know, arriving at a consensus in each state about the equal treatment of LGBT people is very important. And, the result yesterday in North Carolina was immensely disappointing. I believe the Obama campaign put out a statement to that effect. But the work continues. And I think that experience has proven that efforts to deny equal treatment under law to all citizens are not consistent with the traditions of this country that eventually win out over time. And my hope is that we are going to win these battles sooner rather than later. And North Carolina is a great disappointment. But, I think that the tide of history is with us. And I think the president's beautiful statement today is yet more evidence of that fact.
Well, of course, North Carolina is the site of the Democratic Convention, and the president won North Carolina in 2008. We know that Karl Rove used the gay marriage issue as a wedge issue to rally the religious right to the polls. So I guess the real question now is, where is America? Is America still susceptible to the manipulations of the Karl Roves or to the call to our better angels that President Obama made today on ABC News?
I think that where America is today is focused on creating jobs and putting Americans back to work and making sure that we continue to strengthen this economy as it continues to recover from one of the most extraordinary fiscal crises of our lifetime. And I think that if you talk to anybody and ask them whether disagreement over marriage equality is more important to them than making sure that Americans can go back to work, they're going to tell you that you have to get your head examined. This is not what voters are going to be going to the polls thinking about. It's a great day, and I don't want to diminish its importance at all, but in terms of electoral politics, I don't think that this is going to have an impact.
Again, I'm speaking with Tobias Wolff, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the past several years. He is one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. And we're talking about President Obama's statement today to ABC News that I guess he's finished evolving. Is that the word evolving was used on a number of occasions. So,
sure.
And then, of course, preceding his statement today, you had Joe Biden. What's your sense of that, Tobias? Was Joe Biden forcing the issue, do you think, here? Was he off?
That
was scripted.
I mean, Vice President Biden, if he is known for one thing, he is known for speaking from the heart. And I think that's what he was doing on Sunday, and the sentiment was a beautiful one. But he wasn't forcing the issue at all. Absolutely not. This is an administration that is characterized by great cooperation within the White House. And this is not a matter of one wing of the White House trying to push another wing of the White House at all. This was the president's decision.
Well, but do you think then that a lot of people think it was cynical that they were trying to have it both ways? I'm suggesting that maybe it was just, you say Biden was speaking from the heart, and if he was speaking from the heart and without, checking with the boss, it seems to have had an effect if there is a cause and effect here.
Well, to be honest, if folks are interested in that question, it's a question they should probably pose to the folks at the White House. I don't have any insight on that.
Sure.
But what I can tell you is that knowing this president as I do and having gotten to know him over the course of the past 5 years, I don't have any doubt that his interview today represents both a genuine statement on his part and also a statement that he was absolutely ready to make.
Well, what I found interesting about his statement is, and I spoke yesterday with an anthropologist who had a piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago, arguing, and she'd been doing her field work with religious conservatives, with evangelicals in this country, and
right.
was arguing in a way that the left in this country and the Democrats should talk to the religious right. And Obama got 1/4 of the Christian conservative vote in 2008. And it was an interesting discussion in the sense that she was arguing that the president and the Democrats should spell out their religious beliefs more forcefully and not, for example, sell the health care reform bill, assuming that it survives the Supreme Court, on the basis of numbers crunching and that it's going to be good for the economy, but to talk about it in moral terms, in terms of what it does for the people in this country who are suffering. And I got a sense then from what the president said today that maybe he is starting to, because when every time he speaks about his personal religion, I think it's very powerful.
I absolutely agree with you. I'll put the point in broader terms that the Democratic Party needs to be speaking about values, and we need to be speaking about our values. And in the face of a Republican Party that is prepared to really levy an assault upon the equal citizenship status of women, to try to use LGBT people as political, you know, bargaining chips, to seems to have absolutely no concern for the plight of the poor and the working class, and indeed even the middle class in this country, those are all matters of values. And I think that Democrats have values and are promoting values in this election that, frankly, are the right values. And we should not be, I will very much say, I am a Democrat, and we should not be running away from that. To the contrary, we should be making it our top message. I agree.
Well, the president also said that he feels that this issue is generational, and apparently his own children have had some influence over him in that regard. And I know as a parent of a millennial child that my daughter and her entire generation, they are post-racial and post-sexual. This is not on their radar. They simply...
Well, I've heard a lot of people say that, and this is why I say that one of the many reasons that I think that the president's interview today and what he said is so clearly on the right side of history. And, you know, I mean, I think that this election is about a set of values that have been clear for a very long time about having fair and responsible economic policies and having a tax code that reflects the obligations that we all owe to each other in a society. And that's not generational as far as I'm concerned. That's something that we've been committed to in the United States, or should be committed to in the United States, for a long time. But I think you're right that on the LGBT issue, there is a generational shift. And the president has made it clear that he's on the right side of history, and I think that's a beautiful thing.
So just in terms of reconciling the notion, as you pointed out earlier, Tobias Wolff, that the real issues in this election are going to be the economy, and I don't think there's much doubt about that. And in many ways, President Obama's electoral fate is tied to the economy, and conversely, Mitt Romney's made an investment in the economy getting worse, because his whole argument is that I'm the CEO, I'm the business guy, and I can fix the economy. Well, if the economy gets better before November, then he doesn't have a case, you know.
And he's already admitted that, actually. You recall in one of the many interviews that he's trying to pretend never existed several months ago, I believe it was Laura Ingraham, if my memory is correct, who pointed out to him that the economy was getting better and stronger, and he's not going to have much of a message. What is he to do about that? And he responded, you know, it's unfortunate but true. What can I say? It's true. And that's one of those rare moments of honesty that he's been trying to run away from. So I think you're right.
Well, but I was going to suggest, Tobias Wolff, that what we're also talking about is that when the president invokes his own religion and speaks from the heart in terms of his moral values and his religiosity, because after all, the religious right in this country, who are solidly in lockstep with the Republicans, and much of what passes for religion in this country seems to be a kind of front for right-wing politics, it would seem to me that this is a powerful counterattack. And I'm wondering if you can combine those two things. In other words, combine religious values and the economy, because the people who are getting hurt in this economy are the very people that the prophet Jesus told in the scriptures are the ones that we should be taking care of.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not going to presume to speak about what kind of message, how a message ought to incorporate religious beliefs, but I will say this. I think that experience repeatedly demonstrates that what people respond to in a president and in a presidential candidate is a sense of the genuine human being that lies at the core of the man or the woman, and that sense of genuineness is part of what has propelled President Obama into the White House the first time, and I believe will do so again. And I think you're right that it's partly a message about economic policy. There are genuine human stories at the core of economic policy, and it's also partly a message about values. And I'll be very frank to say, I think that's where Mitt Romney has an extraordinary deficit, and I think the public has already seen that, and I think that's what accounts for the lack of enthusiasm in his candidacy. And I think the president's extraordinary statements today can only serve to reinforce the notion that this is a man who speaks as a genuine human being about real human issues.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Tobias Wolff, who is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His research includes the fields of civil procedure and constitutional law, and his advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He is one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's former Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the new Israeli cabinet that's been formed and its implications for whether or not there'll be any movement in terms of peace with the Palestinians.
No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Jennifer Lowenstein and Gabriel Peterberg. Jennifer Lowenstein teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She lived in Israel, where her father played in the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra and studied there in college. She also spent time living in Palestinian refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and is a member of the board of the Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolitions. And Gabriel Peterberg is a professor of Middle East history at UCLA. He grew up in Israel and graduated from Tel Aviv University. He researches the history of the Ottoman Empire and also modern themes such as colonialism, Zionism, and Palestinian-Israeli relations. He's the author of An Ottoman Tragedy, History and Historiography at Play, and The Return of Zionism, Myths, Politics, and Scholarship in Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Lowenstein and Gabriel Peterberg.
Welcome.
Thank you, Ian.
And let me ask you, Gabriel, about this new coalition government between Kadima's leader, Shaul Mofez, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud government. Now they have a majority of 94 seats in a 120-seat Knesset, which is one of the biggest majorities in Israeli history. And Israel's always been plagued by fragile coalition governments. So this sort of came out of nowhere. I take it it happened because Netanyahu threatened to have a new election, and Kadima recognized that they'd be wiped out in a new election, and thus they made this deal. Is that what happened?
Precisely. This is an intersection of petty political interests in which Netanyahu threatened with elections, and I think being always a very overcautious and averse to risk-taking politician, preferred to prolong his term in, as prime minister. And, of course, Kadima fell into his lap because Mofaz, having beaten Tzipi Livni, realized that he was going to be, that Kadima was going to be wiped out in an election, an imminent election. And his members of Knesset, of course, are very wary of losing their seats. So instead of taking I don't know who thought he would, but instead of taking a more courageous and principled oppositional stance, he just joined in as a sort of servile and pathetic little helper of Netanyahu.
Well, that has certainly been the criticism from opposition members in the Knesset, have charged Mr. Mofaz with cheap politics and opportunism, because only a few weeks ago he described the current described the Netanyahu government that he's now joined as being all that is wrong with Israel. What do you make of all this, Jennifer Lowenstein?
Well, I think it's very obviously a political move. I agree, obviously, that Shaul Mofaz recognized that new elections could wipe out the Kadima party, which has been pretty weak in any case. I think just the fact that recently Tzipi Livni was ousted and that Mofaz was made head of Kadima was one indication that people were dissatisfied with the party. And when politicians say something like the Likud party or Netanyahu is all that is wrong with Israel, you can't take it very seriously because they're politicians. He's saving his political neck. He's keeping a lot of people in the parliament. He probably will be somewhat circumscribed in terms of his own power. He'll be, deputy prime minister, something like this. And in the meantime, Netanyahu will continue with Ehud Barak as the defense minister. And contrary to what some people are saying, Iran will stay on what I think of as the front burner. And peace talks with the Palestinians will be purely cosmetic.
So, Gabriel Peterberg, the going back to the elections that brought Likud and Netanyahu in, I recall that Kadima actually got more votes, but they didn't form a government because Tzipi Livni would not form a government with the ultra-Orthodox. So is the ultra-Orthodox, of course, have just come under, first of all, the Israeli Supreme Court have declared the Tal law unconstitutional, and that's the law that allows ultra-Orthodox Jewish seminary students to be exempt from military conscription. And, of course, it's very unpopular in Israel amongst the secularists. Tell us, walk us through what's happened to the deals with the ultra-Orthodox that Tzipi Livni wouldn't make?
Well, the deal is to, first of all, to let them, more than a concrete deal, to let them be the decisive force within a coalition without which a coalition cannot stand, and therefore be able to make all sorts of demands, first and foremost, but not only, to exempt the yeshiva students from military service. I think Tzipi Livni's stance on this is typical of what is called the Israeli seculars, in which everything is channeled to anti-Jewish Orthodox sentiments. And this is the only agenda they really have. And I want to remind you and the listeners that when Barak won in 99 and supposedly created the most dovish government in Israeli history, the main slogan that united all his supporters was just without, the main thing is only without Shas, meaning without the Mizrahi Orthodox Jewish party. In other words, they had no problem sitting in governments with extreme fascist right-wing parties like Lieberman's Israel Beitenu, and they had no problem in the 99 Barak government sitting with settler parties like Mafdal, or NLP in English. But there's something quite, I think, preposterous in my view, or if you will, depressing, in the fact that the only thing that binds them together, all these seculars from Kadima or Likud or Israel Beitenu, is anti-Orthodox religious sentiment and military conscription. There is no other program which has some socio-economic or civic, or to say nothing of the peace with the, or the arrangement or peace or something with the Palestinians. And I think in that sense, it's typical of Israeli politics. The main thing that unites everyone, all the seculars, that is hatred of Arabs and hatred of Orthodox Jews, although in varying degrees, of course.
So, Jennifer Lowenstein, does this mean then that this new Kadima Likud government is free from any leverage that Shas, the ultra-Orthodox, would have?
Well, I doubt that they're completely free from it, but I think in terms of purely strategic maneuvering, the coalition was in many ways a very smart political move. This gives Netanyahu a very stable centrist government. As Mr. Peterberg said, it is one that is going to be dominated by seculars. No longer the Shas party, the religious Orthodox, are not going to be able to threaten every other day to pull out of the government if they don't get this or that law passed in their favor. I mean, there were lots of controversies just in the past year with the Orthodox on, for example, whether or not women should be portrayed in billboards in near Jewish Orthodox neighborhoods. There was a case when there was a 9-year-old child who was stoned, stones thrown at her, literally, for dressing, quote-unquote, immodestly, going towards an Orthodox neighborhood. And justifiably, this angered people. The problem is that it's a social problem. It's something that has to be worked out eventually. And Netanyahu can sidestep it for another year and a half. Mofaz will be there with him. They will have a stable government. But the problem itself is not going to go away. In fact, it's possible that the Orthodox could become even more extreme. And that's not a very nice prospect. As far as the Palestinians go, I think we have a much more important issue. I think that we're going to see more of a stalemated government, because, of course, Netanyahu has always said he's ready to speak, but that he doesn't have a partner for peace. And, of course, the Palestinians, under Mahmoud Abbas anyway, have said that they are ready to speak, but they want no preconditions. That Israel wants no preconditions, and of course that in itself is a precondition. There are preconditions that have to be established when you negotiate with your alleged enemy. You have to make some kind of, you have to have some parameters around which you discuss peace. And this idea that Netanyahu and Mofaz with him now, Kadima and Likud together, can say we will talk peace, but we won't have any preconditions, is not going to lead us very far. It's not going to lead Israel very far. I'm afraid it'll probably worsen the situation of the Palestinians, which in many ways is hard to imagine.
Well, it's as though the Palestinians have become invisible here in the United States, and Netanyahu has been very successful by focusing on Iran and with all of those senior intelligence and military people coming out of the woodwork warning that Netanyahu's bent on attacking Iran. It has put that issue at the forefront, and that Israel's main concern is its existential survival against a nuclear-armed Iran. And meanwhile, the Palestinians have been shunted aside, and they're...
This is very important, because when Netanyahu was here last, in the entire time that he was here, I don't think publicly anyway the word Palestine or Palestinian was mentioned. So there is a part of me that thinks the focus on Iran, while it's very real in Israel, and certainly the current leadership is very hawkish, there is... To some extent, a deliberate attempt to marginalize the Palestinian issue, to sort of, you know, ignore it and it'll go away, while, in fact, they're not ignoring it. The siege on Gaza persists. The conditions in the Gaza Strip are bordering on a catastrophe. And, frankly, the West Bank is not faring a heck of a lot better.
Well, let me ask Gabriel Peterberg about this and the extent to which focusing on Iran is changing the subject from the Palestinians. But the Palestinians, of course, are not going away. There's a lot of hunger strikes in Israeli prisons. A couple of Palestinian prisons are closed to death. What's your sense in terms of whether the Palestinians are going to be find some way to get back on the agenda?
Well, I think increasingly they will, one way or another, which is, I think the way, it's one of these predictions that may be proven wrong, but I think the way the Palestinians will eventually take is to dismantle the Palestinian Authority, which is completely incapacitated, if it hadn't been impotent really from the outset, and find other avenues and other structures and other leadership to create a more meaningful anti-colonial struggle. And they are doing things. The BDS movement is not insignificant, and the fact that it makes the Israel supporters in the United States absolutely hysterical and berserk means that they are doing something effective. So it's not as if the Palestinians are not doing anything, but of course they're resources and capabilities are more limited.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that the BDS movement is having the positive effect.
Tell me about the BDS movement for the benefit of our audience.
The BDS movement the BDS is an acronym for Boycott, Divestment,
Sanctions.
And sanctions.
Jennifer, you think it's not working? Explain that.
No, I didn't say it's not working. I said I think that the BDS movement itself, it may not be having quite the positive effect that Gabriel Peterberg said he thinks that is happening. I actually hope that he's right. But see, I think that the BDS movement is happening at a time when a good majority of Americans still view Israel as the victim, not as the aggressor. And when you see this hysteria and these tantrums happening within the established Jewish community in this country, it gives the BDS movement gives them fuel to portray themselves once again as victims, and this corroborates the propaganda and the stereotypes that the AIPAC lobby and other organizations have been able to indoctrinate people with for years.
Well, first of all, the U.S. is not the only place. I mean, it's working very well in Europe, actually, although I agree that in and of itself, without any other factors to assist it, it's not going to bring the occupation down.
I really have my doubts about it, to be perfectly honest. I'm not convinced that we're ready for a BDS movement. I don't think that Israel is, in the eyes of the American public, equivalent to white South Africa, and I think that's what many people in the BDS movement are trying to portray Israel as.
Well, I'm afraid
I'm
afraid we've run out of time. And Gabriel also brought up the idea that nothing will happen in Palestine until they get rid of their government.
I'm not sure that the new government will be much more effective.
Right.
No, I agree.
Well, look, let's have another conversation because we've run out of time and there's so much we haven't covered. I thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Lowenstein, who teaches Middle East Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She lived in Israel, where her father played in the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra and studied there in college. She also spent time living in Palestinian refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and is a member of the board of the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolitions. And Gabriel Peterberg is a professor of Middle East history at UCLA. He grew up in Israel and graduated from Tel Aviv University. His research is the history of the Ottoman Empire and also modern themes such as colonialism, Zionism, and Palestinian-Israel relations, and is the author of An Ottoman Tragedy, History and Historiography at Play, and The Return of Zionism, Myths, Politics, and Scholarship in Israel. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a longtime Russian scholar.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity, while each for reaching each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go, well, some will you see, some won't be true for you, and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now,
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Service, a British historian, academic, and author who has written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He is currently a professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford and a fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford. His expertise on Russia is broad. He served as an expert witness in the recent trials between Boris Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich in London's commercial court and has written about the recent demonstrations in Russia in the New York Times. His latest book just out is Spies and Commissars, Bolshevik Russia and the West, the early years of the Russian Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Service.
It's great to be with you.
And it's extraordinary how, in many ways, I guess it's a sad fact that in many ways the era that you've written about, of the early Russian Revolution, lives on in a way. You have a KGB officer running Russia, turning back the clock, exhibiting the worst aspects of xenophobia, paranoia, and authoritarianism. And today, of course, Putin presided over the victory parade in Moscow after having basically cracked heads a few days ago on Sunday and on Monday, on the day of his inauguration. Does it depress you as much as it depresses me?
Well, it does, yeah. It really does. I don't think the Russians have deserved the succession that they've had in the past 100 years. I mean, you know, Nicholas II was bad enough. Lenin was, if anything, even worse. Was one of the worst despots in human history, and dictatorship lasted through to the end of the Soviet era, almost. And now they've got something that's so authoritarian and so brutally oppressive politically that one only has to despair of anything better coming out of Russia. Except, you know, people are getting onto the streets now. Unfortunately, they're having their heads broken, but they're standing up to this this appalling administration that they've got.
But what explains, though, how long it has taken for the Western press, and not that Western leaders have absolutely spoken the truth about it? There's a very interesting book out now by Marcia Gessen, Man Without a Face, and she's a very courageous woman for telling the truth. And I just, you know, as much as in your book, Robert Service, Spies and Commissars, there is that continuing kind of apologies for Lenin, suggesting that the Red Terror was forced on him by foreign intervention, etc. And people have gone through hoops to suggest that he was misunderstood and a good guy and Stalin was the one who stole the revolution, etc. And the same mechanism has been in play here with Putin, the denial about who he really is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the answer to why this cycle of misunderstanding recurs is that many people in the West try to sort of think the best of very authoritarian rulers because they simply can't believe that people can be so oppressive. But the other thing that goes on, I think, is that some groups and individuals in the West have an interest in coming to an accommodation with, in the case of Lenin, the early revolutionary administration, and in the case of Putin, with the business elite, the criminal business elite that is presently running the country, but is offering good deals for Western business who are prepared to risk their finance over there.
Well, I suppose the one piece of leverage that exists over Putin that the West has is that Putin is parking all of his money in the West, right?
Yes. Well, the British judicial system is presently acting as a sort of arbitrator on a lot of the commercial disputes that in the 1990s were settled in Russia itself by guns. At least the business environment over there is beginning to turn to the law, but it's not turning to Russian law to the extent that it's turning to British law. And this is one very, very small step in which I was involved in a little bit of before Christmas, which is to the good, but it's a very, very sad reflection on the state of affairs since the fall of communism.
Again, I'm speaking with British historian Robert Service, an author of extensive history on Soviet Russia and from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He's currently professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford and a fellow at St. Anthony College, Oxford, and the author of the new book, Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. Just to touch on briefly before we get to the book, what's the beef between Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich? I mean, I know Berezovsky was involved as a protector of the fellow that was killed by polonium. And again, Marsha Gessam's book points out the obvious, that it was Putin. I mean, it seemed to be clear from day one, but everybody's been equivocating about it. What's the beef between these two billionaires?
Well, these two billionaires are arguing about who promised what to whom. Because I was involved in this case as an expert witness, and because the verdict has not yet been declared, it won't be declared until I'm not allowed actually to make much further comment of it for fear of destabilizing what the proceedings are all about. And there were very, very lengthy proceedings with both Berezovsky and Abramovich themselves appearing in court most days. It was a most extraordinary experience. Hardly imaginable.
Well, it's extraordinary that you have this theater inside and outside of Russia that you just pointed out, Robert Service, that you, in order to get some semblance of justice, now it's the British courts as opposed to the Russian courts, which, of course, one of the first things that Putin did after taking over the press, he took over the judiciary and put the head of UKOS in jail and basically expropriated all the assets. And he essentially regulates the kleptocracy, all of which is based in oil and gas. And you've got all these sort of exiles, and you've got the guys still back there that are in favor. Can you characterize the dance that goes on in KGB Incorporated between the boss, as he's called, and the oligarchs?
Yeah, well, he certainly relies a lot on ex-KGB men. He relies on a system that is an amalgam of intelligence agencies and criminal gangs and people who are willing to sort of act as intermediaries between those two sides of British public life and the elected representatives. But the elected representatives, of course, themselves are as corrupt as anyone else. The people who really lose out of this are the Russians themselves. And one of the positive things about what's been happening in the last few months is that it's educated people, people who go onto the internet, who don't rely on Russian TV for their sources of information, who are taking to the streets. They're very, very brave. It really hasn't happened since the fall of communism, since 1991. It's the one single positive thing that's happened in the last few years. Certainly Putin is not a good thing for Russia. He hasn't diversified and modernized the economy. And without that, Russia is doomed in the years ahead. I think Putin knows this, but he's not done anything about it.
Well, I guess he's just riding on the oil and gas gravy train, and as long as it's up around $100 a barrel, he can keep the show going, right? But if we wean ourselves off oil and oil goes down, then the whole place could collapse.
Well, indeed. Of course, Saudi Arabia would collapse as well. And if you build an economy on your natural resources, really you're mercy of the world market in those natural resources. I mean, there have been so many Russian briefing papers about this. The administration knows what the problem is, but the administration gets very, very rich from the status quo, and it's not really minded to do very much about it.
Let's turn to Robert Service again, British historian, academic and author, who's written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He's currently a professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford, and his latest book is Spies and Commissars, Bolshevik Russia and the West, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. So we'd started out earlier about saying how benighted the Russian people have been for so long, living under despots, and there was that sort of window of hope there when Yeltsin came in, and Putin has pretty much closed that window. Going back to the area that you're writing about, it's a story, I guess, of just not to belabor the Putin analogy, but the thread here is about spies as well as commissars, right? There's always been intrigue. It's almost in the DNA, right?
It absolutely has. And in the early period of the Russian Revolution, going back to 1917, the bulk of the spies were Western rather than communist Russian, because Russia was in a dreadful state and had a civil war, and its intelligence agencies and counterintelligence agencies had their hands full holding on to Russia. The West, for the first year or so, did have a very effective set of espionage agencies, and they were very, very important as information gatherers. Because the diplomats were really not in a position to do the normal job that they had done before 1917, simply because there was simply no recognition of the communist regime, because it was regarded as an illegitimate administration.
Well, clearly, after World War One, the U.S. and the British sent their expeditionary forces, but it seems to have been a kind of, you know, tragicomedy of errors, in the sense that Lenin and the revolutionaries had these delusions of world communism, of taking over the world, and the West were sort of ambivalent or inept in terms of their determination to strangle the revolution in the cradle.
Yeah, you're right. Of course, we know now what happened next. We know that the Soviet administration confirmed itself in power and lasted 70 years, but that wasn't known at the time. And so some Western leaders imagined that perhaps if they did nothing, if they perhaps just blockaded the new Soviet Russia politically and economically, that the problem would go away and that the communists would be overthrown. Some of them thought the best thing to do was to accommodate themselves to Soviet Russia and to have trading relations. And among those countries, Britain was foremost in making a deal with Lenin's Russia. And it did so at the most grievous point in early Soviet Russian history, because it was at that precise moment when the peasants and the workers and the soldiers and the sailors were revolting against Soviet power. And it was at that very moment that British Prime Minister David Lloyd George signed the Anglo-Soviet Trade Treaty, which gave a huge amount of relief to Lenin's government.
After World War II, Attlee gave Stalin the jet engine. There's a history here of, you know, some people would call it appeasement, others would consider it, you know, what, détente? I mean,
I think it goes back further than that. I mean, the Germans traded technology through the 20s and early 30s, then Hitler came to power and all that stopped. And then the Americans took over in the 1930s under Roosevelt. The Ford Motor Company sold its technology, sent over its engineers to help with Stalin's industrialization. I mean, this sort of thing started to cease after the Second World War, when the so-called COCOM agreements started to kick in. And the Americans started to put a block on technological transfer. And that's one of the reasons that the USSR collapsed in the end. It really didn't have access to the advanced technology unless it could thieve it, unless it could conduct industrial espionage that it needed for its own modernization.
So in that area that you're talking about, Robert Service, of course, here in Los Angeles, we have Occidental Petroleum and Armand Hammer.
Right.
And I remember talking with former head of the National Security Agency, and he told me that he had the unenviable task of briefing Ronald Reagan, who was a friend of Armand Hammer, saying that, well, you know, your friend is actually a Soviet agent.
Yeah, well, he certainly was an agent of influence, even at the weakest definition of agent. He was a reliable conduit for the Soviets to carry messages and do commercial deals that perhaps wouldn't otherwise have happened. Yeah, he did a lot of damage, Armand Hammer.
What do you mean he did a lot of damage?
Well, he was one of the agents of influence that the Soviets used in the West to promote a view of the Soviet Union that was much more benign than the reality. And under president after president, he did the same thing on behalf of the USSR.
So he would have been what the KGB used to refer to as a useful idiot.
I'm not sure he was an idiot.
No, he wasn't an idiot.
he built a whole career out of cunningly playing one side against another and making a vast fortune in the process.
Indeed. I'm speaking with Robert Service, a British historian, academic, and author who's written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era of the October Revolution to Stalin's death. His latest book just out is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. So what was, is there anything in terms of future projects that you're thinking of? I mean, most of our discussion has sort of tied the past to the present, and regrettably, it's all too easy to do. Repression lives on, and disappointment continues, and the Russians have been so shortchanged over the decades in terms of what they deserve and what they end up with in terms of governance. I take it, though, that you still have a lot of affection and faith in the Russian people, as indeed I do.
Yes, I do. I think it's going to be difficult for them, but they've got a great culture. They've got a mass of educated people who know what's wrong with the country. If only they had the political opportunities to do something about it, things would be so much better. It's going to take many decades ahead, I think, before things change, simply because the Putin administration is so ruthless and so fortunate in having a very high price on the world market for oil and gas that it's hard to see how it would be undermined in the short term. I'm doing a new project, actually, on the end of the Cold War. It's rather like a bookend to the first book, and to try to see how it was that communism ended in the late 1980s, and what were the factors on both sides in the USSR and in America that affected a series of conciliatory moves between the two countries. I think what happened after the Cold War, though, was there was too much conciliation. There was too much indulgence shown to Boris Yeltsin and then to Vladimir Putin. We're only now beginning to get a second breath.
Well, absolutely. Anything that Yeltsin wanted, it was anything but the communists, and they were never going to come back. It was an absurd policy that Clinton followed, and it was a totally blind policy that George W. Bush followed, you know, saying, looking into his eyes and saw his soul. I mean, surely there's, as a historian, the analogies between Stalin and Putin are pretty clear. They were both small-time thugs, very, very minor individuals, no talent, no vision, you know, but they've literally going to end up ruling about the same period. I mean, I think Putin's got 12 years under his belt, and he's just setting himself up for another 12.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. But I think the popular discontent will grow. The one great lesson in Russian history is that when trouble happens, the rulers are always the first to be surprised. You know, if you think of how the last Tsar was overthrown, a sudden outburst of popular emotion, and people take to the streets, and the forces of law and order go over to the side of the people. It could happen again.
Well, that's probably why Putin drove to his inauguration through empty streets.
Yes.
He's afraid of the people.
Well, afraid of the people, indeed, yeah.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Robert Service.
Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Again,
thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Service, a British historian, academic, and author. He has written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He's currently professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford and a fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. His expertise on Russia is broad. He served as an expert witness in the recent trial between Boris Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich in London's Commercial Court and has written about the recent demonstrations in Russia in the New York Times. His latest book just out is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'll be back again, and assistant producer Maria Trutanich, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.